helping students and healthcare professionals not just survive, but thrive with a purpose. This is the CMDA Student Pulse Podcast with your host, Bill Reichart, National Director of CMDA Campus Ministries.
Well, welcome to another episode of CMDA's Student Pulse Podcast. I'm Bill Reichart, our National Director for Campus and Community Ministries here at CMDA. And my guest is Dr. Tram Jones. Tram, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to talk.
Well, we're gonna have a great opportunity to talk about your journey into becoming a doctor, healthcare, but then missions and how you felt led and called to embark in that. And then a way that God has taken you in an unintentional direction, which is exciting nevertheless, but is something you hadn't expected. So we'll have a chance to share that in just a minute. But before we do, just a couple quick highlights. Well, this is how we got to know each other. You did your medical school at Emory and did your residency there as well, internal medicine. Mm-hmm. You and Hannah had a chance to serve in Haiti for several years and now have moved into a different direction. And we'll talk more about why there was that transition a bit. Now, where are you practicing right now? You're in Atlanta, aren't you?
So, in the U.S., I practice at Piedmont in Athens and Piedmont in Fayette.
Okay.
Yep.
Fantastic.
So, I'm a hospitalist, which is just an internal medicine doctor in the hospital.
Yep. Well, let's stop at the introduction and just dive right into your story. Let's talk a little bit about this journey. I mean, you've sensed a calling to go into medicine, because it's no easy task, endeavor. You obviously must have felt called to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think just going back to the beginning of becoming a doctor, I think the way God has spoken to me is different in different times of my life. I started college as a finance major, and actually finished as a finance major. One of my friends started going into medicine, and I thought, well, you know, actually, maybe I wouldn't want to work behind a desk all day. And so I just started kind of taking science classes, and it kind of became what I was doing. Momentum kind of took me that way. And it's one of those things where I look back and I say, oh, okay, well, I think this was God kind of pushing me that way in a way that was not quite so overt. And I went to medical school, right out of college at Emory.
So we got to know each other through the chapter, you know, the ministry there, CMDA and Emory, but it was really spending some time together in Haiti, which was a medical mission trip we had a chance to do with Global Health Outreach. Was that your first experience in an endeavor like that?
Essentially, I had been to Peru in college. I enjoyed it, but this was the first really truly medical thing that we did. Honestly, I look back on that as probably when my path towards mission work really, really began. Mm. You know, that was my first year of medical school. Mm-hmm. You and I and a bunch of other people went to Port-au-Prince in 2011. It's about a year after the earthquake had hit Haiti.
Right.
So still a lot of rubble on the ground. It was very, Haiti at any time is a very difficult place to work. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is fascinating. This is, feels like you can make a difference here. And I thought, wow, I mean, I'm all in on doing this, except for, I don't know, Haiti seems a little bit tough. So maybe I won't get placed in Haiti. So God has a sense of humor in some of these things.
Well, it was tough, wasn't it? I believe we were crossing the border on that one because...
Yes.
Yes.
We flew into the Dominican Republic and crossed that way, which was adventure in itself.
It was dicey. All these trips can blend together, but I remember one point, the checkpoint, they took their passports and they kind of disappeared with them.
And yeah, very typical. You know, it's funny because I still have vivid memories of that, and I know exactly where we passed because I lived along that road.
Okay.
When I moved to Haiti. So it's this whole, like, I mean, that was 8 years later, but this whole full circle.
Yeah. So that kind of got you thinking. That was, it was provocative. It started to get this process going, this journey, as you were trying to hear from God, were there any other key elements? Like, had you gone to GMHC, the Global Mission Health Conference in Louisville? Were there other things that contributed? How did this begin to develop more than just an idea into something that, as you've already mentioned, became a reality for you years later?
I mean, I think when we went, you know, you're kind of kicked in the face by what you see. It's not, nothing is subtle when you're in Haiti. And so it just started percolating. And so as I went through medical school, everything I learned, I was like, well, you know, I need to learn this, because what if I'm in a place where I'm the only doctor? And it kind of became the driving force for the last few years of my medical school. You know, medical school was busy, and I didn't get to go on any other mission trips, but I just kind of had this idea in my head. I'm like, when I get the chance, this is what I want to do.
Well, how did that chance develop? Because, first of all, where did you end up going? It was in Haiti, but in particular, where did you land?
I'm pretty sure, you know, as I look back into, you mean where did I end up living? I ended up living in Guadeloupe.
Okay.
Which is just north of Port-au-Prince, mm-hmm. Over the river from Port-au-Prince.
Okay. How did that opportunity open up? What was the genesis of that? Because joining a already developed work, or was this creating something new?
Yes, it was kind of interesting, you know. So I was in my residency, and I met my future wife when I was an intern, mm-hmm. And my wife had a love of French, you know, had studied French her whole life, and she majored in it at university, and she thought she was going to be a French teacher, but then she realized, you know what, I actually like nonprofit management, and so she went down that route. And so when we got together, I was like, you know, I really feel like this is going to be part of my life, living overseas at some point. And so I said, well, let's just look at French-speaking countries. I mean, this seems like a natural fit here. And if you're French-speaking countries, you're really thinking about Haiti when you're thinking about the Western Hemisphere. Fortunately, our church, which is Trinity Anglican in Atlanta, we had a longstanding partnership with a clinic that was in Guadeloupe, Haiti. So we talked with the pastor, and we said, you know, we're kind of like thinking about this, discerning this. It was like, well, just why don't you go down for a week and just kind of see if you feel peace about this? Like, does this seem like a place where you could consider doing this? So when I was in my last year of residency, we went down and we found that they were people that we felt like we could trust, people that we could kind of build a life with. And you know, when you're thinking about a move like this, that's the most important thing, is that when you're thinking about a place, is that you find people you can have peace with and that you can trust. Mm-hmm. So we said, okay, this looks good. I mean, this, and there's always, throughout, I've looked back on my own stories, there's the logical side, and then there's the spiritual side, right? Yeah. There's a logical side. It's like, well, we speak French. Right. Our church has a connection. It's the same time zone, you know, direct flight from Atlanta, RIP. But, and then there's the spiritual side, which is God kind of guiding us towards this. We got married right after I finished residency, and we said, okay, right at the end of 2019, we are going to move to Haiti. We're going to give us two and a half years to pay off loans, of which I had a mountain of loans. And so I took kind of the highest paying hospitalist job I could find and just kind of cranked as much as I could, so that we could move. That's kind of how that happened. We started having more conversations with the organization. We would be the first Americans with, that's a smaller organization, the first ones to be on the ground. So we had a lot of conversations with the nurses and doctors on the ground. And then the stateside as well.
Yeah.
Raising support, you know, all the fun things.
Yeah. No, I mean, maybe the analytical side says, you know, it is one of the more strategic places one can go to serve in this. I mean, I was in Niger at a PAC site, and you were pointing out that in the world, UN World Development Index, you know, Niger's like at the very bottom, but Haiti's like hovering right near it. And you don't have to go across the world. It's like literally, like you said, a direct flight from Atlanta.
It is. And, you know, I mean, we say it a lot, you know, Haiti is, it almost gets a tagline of the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, which it is by far, like significantly poorer than any other country in the Western Hemisphere. But I think in terms of the real challenge of living there for the locals and the chaos of individual life, I think it outkicks even its poverty in terms of just the difficulty of day-to-day life.
Yes, yeah, yeah. We saw that, I mean, post-earthquake, which, you know, it was a country already struggling. The earthquake was just like a gut punch. And it, I don't know if they've ever recovered from that. But one of the things which was so endearing was just the beauty of the people, just their heart to, you know, they were trying to, like you said, it was a daily effort to survive and function every day. But, you know, having contact with a church in one of the poorest communities in Port-au-Prince, and to see the life of the gospel shining forth from that, and the impact that that congregation is trying to make for the gospel. You know, we talked about coming from the Dominican into Haiti. The whole purpose of that was about reconciliation, bringing Dominican men and women some logistical support, some medical help to serve alongside the Haitians, which is, you know, if you know the history, that's a big ask. And so, yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful picture of the gospel.
It is.
And, you know, I would always tell my American friends when I lived in Haiti, cost of being a Christian, of doing the right thing in Haiti was very high, you know, because, you know, not that often in the U.S. are you going to be, you know, killed for, you know, making a stand against the gangs or something like this. But in Haiti, that's every day.
Yeah.
And so people who are Christians are like, I mean, they're like, are real Christians.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's a lot to learn. And I mean, I couldn't even keep up with a lot of the prayer meetings, you know, that would go for 2 or 3 hours. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm American. Maybe I need to repent of that. But it was, you know,
yeah.
It's a different type of Christianity.
Amen.
Different faith.
So when did you move, you and Hannah, when did you all move to Haiti then? What year was that?
December 2019, just as we had planned, you know, I think as I look back, set up a lot of ideas of, oh, by my own strength, I can say, boom, here's the date. We're going to go on that date and we're going to make it happen.
Yeah.
Which I think we'll get to it, but it set me up for a lot of lessons.
Yeah. Well, you do get there in 19 and you have a chance to embark on this journey, this opportunity in serving the Haitian people. But, you know, as we've been talking about, it's not an easy place. There's a lot of unrest politically. There's been, I mean, if you know the history again, just constantly, you know, turnabout of new people taking positions of power only to have to flee and to be removed. In this case, though, it got even more serious because there was an assassination in Haiti. And, well, yeah, what was the climate like in Haiti in the years that you were there?
You know, the climate was not great even when we went in. You know, you had seen, there had been some semblance of order, very controversial, but some semblance of order when the UN was there after the earthquake. UN soldiers pull out in 2019. And that's when we went in, and it really exposed the weakness and the failure of the state. I mean, the state pretty much had very little control over even Port-au-Prince, and this just kept sliding out of control. And then in our second year there, in like July of 2021, was when the president, Jovenel Moise, was assassinated. I mean, it's like something out of a Tom Clancy novel. You've got 27 Colombian mercenaries who come and kill him, and no one really knows who paid for it. It's just crazy. Sometimes my life was like, it felt like something that was totally different from my life in the US.
Yeah.
But really, more than causing the problems, I think it was really a symptom of how weak the state had become. Because by that time, maybe the government had control of 30% of Port-au-Prince. Now it's clinging to 15% of Port-au-Prince. I mean, that means the rest of the capital city is run by a hodgepodge of armed groups.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, gangs and everybody just jockeying for power. Yeah.
And it's different from a lot of other countries where you have, you know, maybe one ethnic group is taking over versus another. There are no ethnic groups in Haiti. So it is very almost anarchic where you have these groups that ally and, you know, drop alliances very rapidly. And this is only 5% of the population really that's in these gangs, and they're holding the rest of the population hostage. It was very difficult. I mean, it was one of those things where after you'd been there for a while, though, you needed people to come out and visit you and be like, you know, Tram, this doesn't feel great how you're living. I'm like, it's no big deal. We have tinted windows. We go straight to the clinic. We come home. We don't ever leave.
Well, yeah, it was like just a new normal, you know, just another Monday.
No big deal.
But then something did change. When did it become, what were some of the issues that started to present itself that became, maybe you started to begin to think, well, maybe this isn't, you know, this is a real issue, a problem, and how did, and what decisions was it forcing you to, you and Hannah, to have to make?
Yeah, I mean, I think really the violence, when you first got there, and I'm not gonna say any of this is good, but when you first got there, yes, there were kidnappings, but in general, the kidnappings did not revolve around doctors. In general, they didn't kidnap foreigners. And I remember when the first doctor got kidnapped, because the president came on the air and said, this doctor needs to be released by the end of the day, or we're gonna have retribution. But by the time we left, I mean, it was happening every day. And so it was, nobody even really talked about it very much. And then very slowly, the armed groups started to kidnap Americans, Italians, Canadians, and they started to realize, oh, there is no real problem with this. Nobody's going to stop us, and the potential rewards are significantly higher. So after the president got assassinated, then was probably the biggest, most high-profile kidnapping, which was about a mile from our clinic. They kidnapped 18 Americans and one Canadian. That made major news. It was very brazen. Held them for 9 weeks. And that was the time when our staff said, you know, you're the only expats. There's 50 of us Haitian doctors and nurses that can keep things going. You need to leave. And so we left. And that was very hard, very, very
yeah,
hard.
Describe, I mean, what were some of the emotions you and Hannah were struggling with through that transition?
I mean, it's a lot. You know, I think I had built up, you've got to think, you go through medical school, you go through residency, you pay off your loans, and everything is targeted towards this, and it becomes part of your identity, right? You're like, oh, and it's so easy for it to become part of your identity because it's good work, right?
Right.
You're saving lives. And it's, I feel like it's that thing where the devil doesn't really have to throw you all the way off. He just has to get you just a little bit off. And after a while, you find yourself really diverged from where you should be. And so for me, it was this loss of identity of, this is what I always thought I would do, where my meaning came from. Now what? You know, and so spiritually that was very challenging. I mean, obviously there was the, oh, okay, we're back in the US, we don't have a home, we don't have what do we do now?
Yeah.
I mean, you figure that stuff out, right? But the breaking down of your identity, that's the hard part. And I mean, I think anybody listening to this probably can see that that's a good thing that that's broken, mm-hmm. right? But it's not a fun process to go
right.
through.
No, it isn't at all. Well, you went through it. You allowed God to take you through it, clinging and, you know, relying heavily on Him throughout that transition back to the States. But you pivoted, and I don't want to steal your thunder. So, how did you pivot? What were some of the changes you saw, and how did that come about? Was it as intuitive in thinking this is what we're going to do, or were there some things, doors that opened that kind of made this a possibility, something you hadn't necessarily thought that was a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, no one had really thought that this was something that we could do. But basically, as our time in Haiti was ending, we realized we couldn't get any specialists to come out to the clinic. Mm-hmm. Even not being that far away from Port-au-Prince, no one was. Basically, any doctors who were left in Haiti that were specialists were predominantly in the wealthier parts of Port-au-Prince. I mean, there's some spattering here and there. But I had patients with seizures, patients with bad skin diseases that needed to see a dermatologist. And so I said, okay, let's set up a teleclinic, one of the rooms dedicated to where doctors from the States or from Haiti can video in, see the patient, prescribe medication, and we'll do that. Little did I know that a few months later, I would have to be using that to see my own patients. And, you know, it wasn't like we had planned it that way, but it just, yeah. I think that's the part where you leave room for the Holy Spirit of figuring mm-hmm. these things out.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
It's ironic that the thing that I planned was crashing and burning, but maybe the thing that God was planning was the embers were starting to grow.
Yes. So that infrastructure is what now you're tapping into, the telemedicine in Haiti, but it's going beyond that. How has the scope of this opportunity gone well beyond just Haiti itself?
Yeah, so I mean, at first it was just me, you know, mm-hmm. I was like, okay, I just gotta do this. Then I spoke with another organization that was working in Cité Soleil, which is the biggest slum mm-hmm. in Haiti. They said, well, we can't get a doctor, we can't get a nurse into this zone, but we can do teleclinics. And so we said, okay, well, we'll do it there too. I started bringing my resident doctors along with me so they could rotate with me and see patients. But I thought, you know what, I really need a third site where it's preferably English speaking, where I can really try to see if I can get other doctors to come on board and volunteer with this. Because I started to see, you know, traditionally we had two options. It was go live, which is what I had done, or you can do short-term mission trips, which I obviously love. I mean, that's what sparked my desire to go. But you have a lot of doctors who can't go for any number of reasons, family, practice, maybe they have a sick kid. Mm-hmm. And I'm an internist, I'm not a surgeon. So I needed long-term follow-up. Mm-hmm. And so I saw, okay, you know what, with teleclinics, I can see patients every week, every other week, and actually be able to follow these patients long-term, which is really what I needed as an internist. Mm-hmm. So I started looking around the world, and I'll do that framework again, the spiritual versus the analytical. Analytically, I said, okay, it needs to be a good time zone. It needs to be English speaking. It needs to have Starlink internet so I can get high speed internet. Mm-hmm. It needs to have a very low doctor to patient ratio. And Sierra Leone kept coming up as one of those options. Mm-hmm. And then the spiritual side was, talked with somebody in my neighborhood who'd just gone on a trip to Sierra Leone, and it was like, oh yeah, there's a clinic at the school that I was working at. And you know, I was like, okay, well, let's explore this a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it turned out this clinic, I mean, it 22 nurses, did one birth per day, did overnight observation, HIV clinic, but no doctor. Mm-hmm. So I said, listen, I mean, we can figure out a way to get you a doctor once a week. Mm-hmm. To see your complicated patients. So that started a long conversation, and I went to Sierra Leone in February, and we've been doing telemedicine once a week since then.
I mean, what's the price point of Alf? Well, let me back up and say, was this clinic outfitted with the technology it needed? And if not, what's the price point of outfitting a clinic with this tech?
Yeah, so we partnered with the organization that was there to input Starlink. Mm-hmm. Starlink costs about $500, $600 mm-hmm. in low-income countries to install, and then it's usually around $50 to $60 a month. Then we needed to get power, and that varies a little bit. Mm-hmm. Solar is sometimes the option, but here we're using inverters and batteries, so it's not super expensive. But then you've got to have the other equipment, computer, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I mean, overall, it's a very low,
yeah,
very low price. I mean, and we're not running the clinic, I want to be clear.
Right.
We're taking clinics that exist,
yes,
that don't have doctors, and saying, we can give you a doctor regularly.
Oh, and I imagine having that contact is just a game changer for them, given you said there was no doctor on site for this one clinic in Sierra Leone, right?
No, and I mean, for an American, 22 nurses, no doctor, that's crazy for us. Mm. But in Sierra Leone, you only have 600 doctors in the entire country of 9 million people. My hospital that I trained at, Grady, mm-hmm. has 1,100 doctors. So you're basically, a vast majority of the population is never going to see a doctor in their life.
Yeah.
You know. And so our dream as we mm-hmm. build this out is to say, okay, now that we can show that this works, let's go to the remote areas mm-hmm. and say we can get a doctor regularly in remote areas.
So yeah, you're seeing a vision for this to begin to grow and to scale beyond just these. I mean, Lord willing,
Lord willing.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, I mean, I just think there's a lot of doctors in the U.S. that have hearts to serve, and there are practical barriers to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
In places like West Africa,
yeah.
Or Haiti, you know.
Well, yeah, no, I think this is exciting. That same kind of vision, Tram, was what prompted our movement into Clarkston at the time, when we were thinking, you know, this is the world at our doorstep. And if I
yes.
can get doctors who may not go across the world but can step outside their door to another neighborhood across the street, they're more likely to do that, or they have more accessibility. And so that was the vision that prompted that. So I could see the vision. And I mean, what kind of commitment would you could say for yourself, although I think you probably have a higher maybe commitment level than most, but what would be the minimal kind of commitment that a doctor could make? It is required a couple hours a week, or?
No. What I'm looking for is 1 to 2 clinics per month.
Mm.
And you're not looking at a full day. You're looking at 2 hours, because
okay.
what we've started streamlining this in Sierra Leone. Okay, we've got the patients ready to go as soon mm-hmm. as the doctor is there. We've already got vitals, we've got chief complaint, all of that already texted to the doctor. And then as soon as the doctor steps in the room, okay, boom, we're seeing patients.
Okay.
And so the idea is you can start seeing those patients pretty quickly. And then 1 to 2 hours,
mm-hmm.
you finish seeing your 10 patients, because you're trying to get the nurses to pick the more complicated cases that
yeah.
we see.
Right.
Because, I mean, you and I have seen, when you have a clinic, like in Haiti, a number of people come in for headaches and
mm-hmm.
Dry eyes. And I love treating that too. But when you're trying to be like, okay, I want to make this really worth
yeah.
this doctor's while, we're trying to get those complicated yeah. cases.
So how many other physicians do you have around you part of this opportunity?
So in the last 2.5 years, we've seen 1,500 patients this way.
Wow.
We've had 20 doctors, all residents. So I have residents that will
okay.
see them, and 2 attendings do this.
Okay.
But my goal is to start having this more, because what I realized was in Haiti, it was very hard for other doctors, because there were so many, you had to find somebody who spoke Haitian Creole.
Mm.
You had to find somebody that, you know, it was very niche. And so that's why we've kind of opened up Sierra Leone to try and say, okay, let's make this accessible to a lot of doctors.
Well, could this expand? I mean, we've got listeners all across the country. They may be asking, Tram, how I'm in Duluth, Minnesota. How do I get connected with something like this? How could I utilize my desire, my passion, my gifts, my skills to an endeavor like this?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to talk with anybody who's interested. I don't know if there's a way for me to put my email out there with this podcast.
We can, and yeah, so with your permission, we'll do that. We'll put it in the show notes. We can connect that up, or people can always reach out to us and we can make the introduction.
Yeah, and you know, what this always entails mm-hmm. is some training mm-hmm. because practice, as I realized, so different mm-hmm. in Haiti and Sierra Leone than it was in the U.S. And it's not just the simple, oh yeah, the diseases mm-hmm. are different. There's not a lot of malaria in the U.S. But it's the medicines are different. Mm-hmm. Your threshold to hospitalize is different. I always talk about that. Like, okay, in the U.S., we hospitalize for anything where there's really any possibility that something bad's going to happen. chest pain rule out, you know, just to make sure.
Yeah,
right. But here, you're a hospitalization could be financially ruinous for a family. Yeah. So you've got to really use your thought process. Okay, when do I need to do this? And those thresholds are very different mm-hmm. than they are in the U.S. So we go through a lot of training like mm-hmm. that before we start seeing patients.
Mm. Are there... Is this kind of changing somewhat the paradigm of how medical mission and opportunities cross-culturally like this are being executed more with the technology now becoming much more available? Are we seeing more of these opportunities?
Yeah, I think that's my hope, because mm-hmm. even for surgeons, you know, surgeons go in, you do an operation, you leave. Well, now you've got the technology that you can do follow-ups, right? Mm-hmm. Where, you're not there physically, but 2 weeks later, you can do a follow-up video call.
Mm-hmm.
We know this well in the U.S. because we're all used to telemedicine. But this is a little, I just want to be clear, we do this a little bit different because okay. the patients are not sitting at home on their yeah. phone, right? They're coming to the clinic. The patient is always with the nurse mm-hmm. who's helping with physical exam. You're communicating with the nurse on what to prescribe.
Yes.
Because a lot of patients and even nurses are not that adept at technology.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of training mm-hmm. building up that has to go into this.
Well, this has been fascinating. It's been great to watch your journey and how God has taken you through all of these different seasons. Yes, not always making sense analytically, but the Spirit moving and doing and accomplishing His way and purposes in some, and believe me, I can bear testimony to that in my life, and I think anybody who follows Christ for any amount of time can say, yeah, it's God works in mysterious and unexpected ways, and but this is an exciting piece of this journey, is watching this technology being used for God's glory to be able to so effectively come alongside nationals who are doing the healthcare that they can, but this is an extension. This is an opportunity to add more, hopefully more health and healing for these patients where they're more complicated scenarios that with you and your specialties, you guys can add an extra measure of help and assistance, so.
Yeah, and your hope is, you know, okay, we have the doctor available once a week, mm-hmm. say, but on the other days, these nurses have done visits with the physician.
Yeah.
So you're getting that hands-on, mm. one-on-one training that's even just by osmosis of being together, taking care of yeah. patients. So I kind of love that aspect.
That's great. Well, before I sign us off, anything left unsaid? I mean, I know we covered a lot, but Tram, I mean, you've got listeners, again, students along different levels of their training, residents, even attendings listening. Anything you want to leave our audience with before we sign off?
I mean, I just think that when you're thinking about doing global missions, I think being flexible, being willing to be knocked down, mm-hmm. to be, you know, humbled, mm-hmm. Not in the sense of, I always like to make fun of people who are like, I'm humbled when I get this award. No, it's like humbled when you get knocked down, mm-hmm. and to be able to say, okay, let's just try and pivot and figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the key in navigating this.
That's great. Well, this has been a fun conversation and exciting to see what the Lord has been doing in and through you and Hannah's life and family. A couple of kids, right?
Couple of kids. Yeah, I've got a 2.5-year-old Agnes, and then my son is 8 months old,
Wonderful.
Felix.
What a blessing. Yeah, I know a lot's changed since we've all met up with each other. And I've got two children, both married, and three grandchildren. So life marches on.
Life moves on,
It does.
yes.
Well, good, Tram. Thank you so much for joining us for this time together. And thank you, all of you listening and watching. We look forward to seeing you next time on the next episode of the Student Pulse Podcast. We'll see you then. Well, it's this time of the podcast where we tell you some things you need to know. As always, you can find CMDA Student Life on all of our social media properties using the handle and username CMDA Student Life. And you'll find us on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, X. And if you go to cmdastudentlife.org, you'll find a section in there for show notes. And so you'll be able to get all the important links that we discussed in this episode. Well, thank you again for joining us for this episode of CMDA Student Pulse Podcast. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time. CMDA's Student Pulse Podcast is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the organization. CMDA is non-partisan and does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Student Pulse Podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members.